As we were editing this episode of Explore, both the men's and women's Everesting records were broken within a few days of each other. First, Britain's former world time trial champion, Grande Boucle, and Flèche Wallonne winner Emma Pooley took 15 minutes off Hannah Rhodes' record, which was set on June the 4th. Pooley rode the Hagen Egg climb in central Switzerland, which is 6.8 kilometres long at an average gradient of 13%, and to reach the magical 8,848 metres of vertical gain needed to set an Everesting record, Pooley took 8 hours 53 minutes and 36 seconds. Then Alberto Contador, who's won the Tour de France, Giro d'Italia and Vuelta a España before retiring at the end of 2017, broke the men's record, which had been held by Lachlan Morton, who rides for EF Pro Cycling. Contador rode the Silla del Rey in the Sierra de Guadarrama, just north of Madrid. His time was 7 hours 27 minutes and 20 seconds, taking almost 2 minutes off Morton's time. Silla del Rey means King's Seat, by the way, which is quite appropriate. Both records have been verified by Hell's 500, the group that has created and organised the idea of riding the height of Everest by climbing and descending the same hill multiple times. In this episode, we'll hear from Andy van Bergen of Hell's 500, and both of the now deposed record holders, Lachlan Morton and Hannah Rhodes. But don't let the fact that both those records have fallen deter you from listening to this episode and their fantastic accounts of taking on a very difficult challenge. After all, records are there to be broken. And who knows, by the time you're listening to this, maybe even Pooley and Contador's times will have fallen. Now over to the show.
You're listening to Explore by the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by Iwaka. Flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
Hello and welcome to Explore. My name is Lionel Burney and I'm joined as usual by Hannah Troop. Hello, Hannah.
Hello, Lionel.
And again by Ian Boswell, former Team Sky and Katusha pro rider, of course, and host of your own podcast, Ian, Breakfast with Boz.
That's right. I actually called up your colleague, Richard Moore, to have him on a forthcoming episode of Breakfast with Boz. So yeah, it's going both ways here.
Interesting that. Interesting you selected Richard and not me to talk about the Tour de France. But, you know, I don't hold any grudges whatsoever.
So there's no competitiveness between you three whatsoever, is there?
Absolutely not. No, I'm happy with my silver medal. So what have you been up to in the last few weeks since we last spoke?
Yeah, well, I've been still at my home up in Vermont. I've been doing a fair bit of riding. I've actually been doing a lot of KOM hunting, kind of marking my territory up here while other folks aren't riding around. So I've been riding, working, like you said, I've been working on some podcasts, and my wife and I are, I know we spoke about it last month, but actually have the equipment now to get ready for a bike pack trip, which we will do next Monday.
Excellent. And taking some recording equipment, going to make a sort of home from home portrait of cycling and domestic bliss is what I'm imagining.
Exactly. Yeah, we actually had my wife and I have a little A-frame cabin at the back of our property that some friends who did a cross Vermont bike pack trip stayed at this week. So I was able to go and talk with them and kind of see their equipment. And I am blown away by how little equipment they actually brought with them. I mean, some of the just the ability to, you know, make sleeping bags so small and tents that are essentially nothing. We have what we need, but I feel like if I am to get more into bike packing over time, I'm going to need some lighter weight equipment.
So planning to pack light, but not too light. You don't want to go without any of the essentials, I guess.
No, I mean, their advice was, you know, after a couple of trips, you'll know what you need and what you don't need.
Indeed. Well, I think it was in our previous episode with Emily Chappell, Hannah, wasn't it? Whose advice was to go with the absolute minimum and work out what it was you missed. So that you would know for next time, rather than sort of pack everything and plus the kitchen sink and work out what you didn't need. Actually go and find out on a short test trip what it is that you can live without.
Yeah, I think if you then start to plan to cycle across the continent of Europe, you quickly work out that there's some stuff that you want to get rid of so you don't have to carry it.
You're listening to Explore by the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by Iwaka. Flexible loans built for small businesses. If you run a business, find out more at iwoca.co.uk, iwoca.co.uk.
Explore is supported by iWoca, a company which helps small businesses by making it easier and more flexible to borrow money for a whole range of purposes. Cash flow is often a big issue for small businesses, and the coronavirus crisis has put a lot of companies under pressure. But some have been lucky enough to see an increase in demand for their products or services. Let's hear from Richard, the owner of Power Bikes, an e-bike specialist company that started with premises in Whitehaven in Cumbria and now also has a shop in Dumfries. With interest in e-bikes rising because of the coronavirus crisis, he's been very busy lately. Not that long ago, Richard applied to iWoca for a loan. Let's hear his story.
My name is Richard Underwood. I'm the owner of Power Bikes. We are an electric bike specialist company. First start of trading, that will be 1st of August 2017. We started on a small industrial estate in Whitehaven, kind of tucked out of the way. So it started a little bit slow, but once word got out that there was an e-bike shop in town, it grew quite quickly. I think we started our store just at the right time when people were really starting to recognise the benefits of e-bikes. And of course, now just recently, sales have gone absolutely crazy. I'd had conversations with my bank and I just wanted a little more money to help with cash flow. So I spoke to the bank. I spoke to iWoca just out of curiosity, and they actually made it a lot quicker and simpler than the bank. Basically, the bank wants to know what colour underwear you're wearing for the next 6 months and everything else. iWoca, they took the essential information, made a decision, and okay, it cost me a little more in interest, but you pay for convenience a little bit sometimes. And the money was in the account much quicker, and that straight away is going to benefit a business, because if cash flow is what kills small businesses, if you run out of that, then the business disappears. So money in the bank quicker, much more beneficial for us. Yeah, well, here we are today, absolutely flying because of it.
iWoca is also accredited by the UK government to offer CBILS, that's the Coronavirus Business Interruption Loan Scheme, to help businesses get through this period of uncertainty. To find out more about that and the other ways iWoca can help your small business, go to iwoca.co.uk. And if you fancy an e-bike, check out Power Bikes. Well, it's July as we speak, the start of July. Hannah, we were hoping to be at the Tour de France. I would have been there covering the race. You would have been there working for EF Pro Cycling. I mean, Ian's actually ridden and finished the Tour de France. So, I mean, you know, we can't really compete with that. But it's left a bit of a gap in the middle of our summer, hasn't it? How have you been filling it?
So actually, we are now fully out of lockdown. We're in the new normal, as we're now calling it. And so basically I've just been like hanging out at the pool, going to the beach every day, riding my bike. So I've been feeling it pretty well, to be honest with you. It's been like being on summer camp.
Nice. Well, I've been riding every day since the Tour de France should have started on June the 27th. I've been doing something that in my head I've been calling the Tour de Home. So the plan is to ride every day for 21 stages, giving myself a couple of rest days so I've got the flexibility to cope with work and childcare and just the weather not being all that great. But I've been enjoying it so far. I've been clocking up the miles, and yesterday I did a ride, half of a ride that we used to do in the run-up to Christmas called the 12 Hills of Christmas, basically crisscrossing the Chiltern Hills here in southern England, and I did six of them just to see how many meters of vertical gain I would clock up in what was it, it was around about 60 kilometers of riding, a slightly feeble and disappointing 600 meters it turned out to be. I thought it would be a lot more than that. And the reason that I did that ride, just to get a sense of the amount of vertical gain I'm notching up on my rides, was because this episode is dedicated to the phenomenon of Everesting, which in a way is kind of the antithesis to exploration on a bike, isn't it? Certainly in the physical sense, because in order to complete a legitimate Everesting ride, you have to climb and descend the same hill until you've completed 8,848 vertical meters. That's the height Everest stands above sea level, of course. And during lockdown, Everesting has really captured the imagination, because I guess people have been restricted a little bit in their movements. And so one thing that people could do is pick a climb local to them and go and ride up and down it until they reach that magical 8,848 metres. And in this episode, we're going to hear from two of the recent record breakers, Lachlan Morton and Hannah Rhodes. Plus, we'll hear from Andy Van Bergen, who I guess has become the authority on all things Everesting, and he's the man who verifies each attempt. And we'll also hear from a Frenchman called François Siouan, who may very well have been the first ever person to successfully complete an Everesting attempt on a bike. Not recently, but 36 years ago on July the 1st, 1984. So Everesting then, a very simple concept, isn't it? Meters gained to take you to the summit of the highest mountain in the world, 8,848 meters gain on a bike in a single ride. It's a very simple concept, and I wanted to know how it all came about, because it's something that has been a fairly recent phenomenon, especially with lockdown. I wanted to find out about the roots of Everesting, and I was put in touch with a man called Andy Van Bergen, who is near Melbourne in Australia, and he runs Everesting CC, the website, and Hell's 500, which is kind of the body which has become, I guess, the gatekeepers for Everesting. So last week I caught up with Andy on the phone.
You can imagine if one person had done an Everesting climbing 8,848 meters, it would have got a lot of coverage. So I just knew that all of a sudden, if we were to explode onto the scene without anyone knowing about it, and then all of a sudden there's dozens of people that have done this on one weekend, it'd get talked about, and that's exactly what happened. I've always been interested in climbing hills as a rider, and kind of as a rider, there weren't many organized events that really catered to that idea of being able to ride up and down hills a lot. You know, most of the events that were in my area in Melbourne and Australia were generally fairly flat. And, you know, once we've done all of them, we kind of grew a little bit bored of them as well. So with a group of friends, in fact, it was myself and my uncle at that stage, we would just go and create our own challenges. We'd just go and do harder and harder things every year. And kind of the whole idea behind these challenges was to pick something, Lionel, that you just couldn't do the next day. You had to train for it over, say, a winter, and it was a good excuse to call each other out of bed in, you know, when it was dark and raining outside and things like that. So every year these epics that we would do would just get bigger and bolder and brasher. And after about 5 years of that, it kind of got to the point where people were starting to hear about these rides. Of that time, I know it's kind of normalized now, but of that time, if you were to do a ride of 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 vertical meters, people would talk about it. And, you know, we would find that we'd get coverage on local radio or in a cycling publication or something like that for doing one of those rides. And I know that's so normal now, but these rides really did stand out. So we would get people from all over the world saying, "Hey, Andy, I want to come and join these rides that you're doing." And it kind of got to the point after a couple of years of that, that by 2014, I knew that I needed to create something that would cater to riders from anywhere in the world. You know, because I'd had people saying, "Oh, I want to fly over from France or from the States or, you know, from the UK or wherever it might be." And obviously, I wasn't interested in creating a big physical event. And maybe 2012 or so, that I'd read this article about a mountaineer who had a bit of a famous name. His name was George Mallory, who was the grandson of the George Mallory, who had attempted to climb Mount Everest and unfortunately lost his life on that mountain. So George was training to mountaineer Mount Everest. And during that training, he would ride repeats of different hills over and over again. And that was kind of his cardiovascular training. Anyway, he wrote this report of it a couple of years later, because basically in 1994, he attempted to, in his training, ride up and down Mount Donabuang until he climbed the height of Everest. He thought it was a neat little goal to tick, that during his training, he would climb the height of Everest on a bike. And that's what he was actually planning on doing, mountaineering as well. So I'd read about this. It had been brewing in the back of my mind for a couple of years. He did that ride back in 1994. I read about it nearly 20 years later. And there was just this beautiful idea of, okay, well, here's something that potentially people could do anywhere in the world, they would just pick one hill and they would just ride up and down that until they climbed the equivalent height of Mount Everest. There was something really pure and beautiful about that, that kind of led to that idea of, okay, well, here's something that we can all do together, and we can all be united in this one simple act of Everesting.
So when was your first official or semi-official Everesting attempt?
That was in February of 2014. Yeah, reached out to this community of people that I said, you know, had wanted to come and ride with us. And it was over 100 people. They were sworn to secrecy, let them in on this idea. And they had a couple of months to train for that. We all picked different hills all around the world. And under the cover of darkness in February of 2014, we all set out to do this Everesting that was something that no one had ever heard of. There was a lot of them that were in Melbourne. That's where our crew was based. My own Everesting that I chose was a climb that was really important to me, and that was, it's called Mount Buller, and it's about 3 hours to the east of Melbourne. So I took my whole family out there. We drove out there for the weekend. And yeah, like, I think the tricky thing about it was there wasn't really any precedent. We had no idea what it was going to be like. You know, this was going to be one of the longest rides I've ever done on the bike, obviously the most amount of climbing, and the length of time on the bike as well was something that I'd only really done maybe once or twice prior to that. So yeah, it was an interesting weekend. I've still got the original email that I sent out to the crew, and basically I'd set some parameters there, because, you know, the more you think about a challenge like this that's non-geographically specific, but you want people doing the same thing, the more you realize, okay, well, there needs to be some basic boundaries. And those boundaries still stand today, and they're fairly simple. You pick one hill, you ride repeats of that hill on the same climb until you climb the height of Mount Everest. You can't sleep, and it has to be in one activity. So you can't do it over multiple days or anything like that. So they're kind of the fundamental rules. And then there were some sort of additional rules that surrounded that as well, which went into a little bit more detail. But fundamentally, those basic rules are what have guided the global community of Everesters ever since.
And there's something, it strikes me, quite egalitarian about it, because different riders can choose a different climb that either, as you say, means something to you or suits them better. Some people might want a longer, slightly more gradual gradient. Others might be quite happy with a shorter, steeper climb.
You know, one of the most wonderful things and about this particular challenge is something that I think I try to build into anything that I'm creating. And that's this idea of flexibility within a framework. And you know, the idea behind that is, you know, we provide a framework, but really people can bring this to life in their own way. And, you know, you mentioned hill selection, which is obviously important, but people can choose whatever bike that they like as well. You know, they can ride it indoors, or they can ride it on a mountain bike, or, you know, there's been unicycle Everestings and brakeless track bike Everestings, and people can get kind of really creative with that as well. But it also allows you to, you know, include charities or include special causes or do it for other reasons as well. There's a lot of flexibility within it.
I mean, obviously the symbolism of Everest, the world's highest mountain above sea level, you know, is obvious, but it strikes me listening to you talk about the kind of the origins and George Mallory being the grandson of George Mallory, you know, this whole idea is rich with symbolism, isn't it?
It truly is. I grew up reading mountaineering books. I've never had the desire to do it as well, probably because I've read so many books and I know how treacherous it can be, but I'm just fascinated by the culture. You know, when we first launched Everesting, the whole deal, like for a week or two, was that, you know, you had to be the first on the climb, and if you were the second, it didn't count. You know, you had to be first, and that was it. And like we launched that weekend, and I think the very first article that came out about it a day later, there was all these comments about that particular rule, and yeah, we entered into some interesting debate. And I'm so glad that was one thing that we changed, because I think one of the wonderful things about it is there'll always be a particular honor that goes to the person who is first. But like Mount Everest itself, you know, anyone can climb that and get amazing kudos for doing that.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast Team Car, the back of the pack, please.
This episode of Explore is supported by Babbel. Now, if you're thinking of visiting another country when you can finally get on your bike and go and explore, you want to be able to speak a bit of the language, don't you? I find it always comes back to me over the course of the Tour de France. My A-level French sort of begins to return to something approaching useful. I've been actually doubling up with Babbel recently. I've been doing the Italian course from the beginning, and I've been trying to brush up on my French as well, and it's become a bit of a habit already, really. I've been using the app on a daily basis. I get a little reminder on my phone to do my 15-minute lesson, and I work through the exercises and the process of getting the answers right. It's a real morale boost when you hear the little bing to say that you've got the answer right, or that you pronounce something not too badly. Something that I'm sure Daniel Freeb and Rob Hatch of the Pronunciation Police would be absolutely agog to hear that my pronunciation is coming along. Anyway, Babbel can help you with one of 14 different languages or more, if you please, including Spanish, French, Italian, and German. The lessons have been lovingly created by over 100 language experts, and that's real people, not a machine. And so you are using sentences as they would be used in the country by a native speaker. And I always think that helps your working through real life examples that will be useful to you right from the off. So if you would like to try out Babbel, they're offering all of our listeners 6 months free if you purchase a 6 month subscription by using the promotion code Cycle. So go to babbel.co.uk/play and use the promo code Cycle when you sign up for a 6 month subscription. That's babbel.co.uk/play and use the promo code Cycle, or check it out in the App Store. And so once you'd created this thing and you just released it into the world, really, as an idea, and it kind of bubbled away, and I'd heard of it over the years, but it's really in the last few months that it's become something of a phenomenon. For understandable reasons, cyclists might be able to ride without going too far from home, for example, once if they were locked down, once lockdown was released and so forth. But also the fact that higher profile riders have attempted, and well, in the case of Lachlan Morton, attempted twice to break the Everesting record.
Sorry, Lucky.
well, this was what I wanted to get onto. I mean, first of all, just on the fact that we've all been to a greater or lesser extent contained our kind of adventurous spirit and our exploratory opportunities have been curtailed a bit for a while, depending on where you are in the world. There's something about the fact that you can go and really test yourself against one hill. Suddenly, it grew an extra dimension almost.
Yeah, it really did. And I think there's a couple of reasons why it's really exploded into popularity. And like you said, Lionel, you know, we know that people have known about this concept for a long time, just the way that it's referenced. And probably even a year ago, it was really interesting to see that when people were talking about Everesting, it was no longer followed by, which is the act of climbing repeats of the same hill until you climb the height of Mount Everest, which is something we'd seen for years, whereas now just you could say the word Everesting and generally cyclists would know what it is that you're talking about. And we also knew that it was being talked about in the pro peloton. There'd been a couple of pro riders that had done earlier Everestings, Jens Voigt and Richie Porte and Cam Wurf, and you know, the isolation wherever you were around the world that had different layers of isolation. You know, in some places like obviously France and Spain and Italy, you literally couldn't leave your apartment. So the idea of being able to use all this training that you had and all this, like you said, adventurous energy and channel that into a challenge in your own living room, basically on a trainer on Zwift, that was really powerful. And, you know, straight away we saw a big increase in people doing virtual Everestings, which is something that we've been doing for a couple of years. But then, like you said, you know, there were a whole bunch of pro riders and influencers who had talked to us before and said, you know, they're very interested in the concept, but unfortunately would never fit in with their training regime, or the coach would perhaps, you know, maybe frown upon spending that amount of time outdoors on a bike. Whereas now there was all this free time because there was no pro racing. We saw this real increase in both people participating on it online, but then also these, you know, idols of the sport taking it on and, you know, seeing amazing riders, whether it's Ruth Winder or Katie Hall or, you know, one of my favorite riders, Rebecca Rush or Littlecrow, Cavendish, Henderson, whatever it was, like all these idols of the sport participating and doing this thing, it really, you know, opened it up to more people. But, you know, I think the thing that had the biggest impact was the more local effect. So the idea is that, you know, Lionel, you might have a friend in a club who's done an Everesting, and then all of a sudden you think, oh, well, if Joe can do it, then I can do it as well. You know, the pro riders are going to go back to racing fairly soon, but it's really the pipeline that's been built by that network effect of real life people that are doing it, you know, regular cyclists, and that's where the real explosion has happened.
So for you, is it the achievement of just completing the challenge, or is it actually the pursuit to lower the you know, the amount of time it takes, you know, break the record for an Everesting attempt? What really kind of fires you?
Oh, absolutely the former, and the records are something that's actually really interesting, that, you know, we never ever intended that to happen, and in fact, you know, before Phil Guymon broke the record a month or two ago, that record had stood for a good 2 years. You know, we intentionally never highlighted the records either, because at the end of the day, this is a personal challenge, and, you know, the last thing we ever want to do is encourage people to, under duress, be racing a little bit harder than they need to be. At the end of the day, this is an endurance challenge, and you're just doing it for yourself. However, like, it's been amazing seeing the pros take on Everesting, and, you know, I feel like I'm a bit of a bystander in all of this as well, just seeing, wow, like, I wonder what is possible. But I think the good thing is, those records are only really in the realm of pro riders now and experienced riders. And we've actually just, you know, intentionally asked our community not to race it, basically. So we don't highlight country records. We don't highlight age records or anything like that, because it's really not in the spirit of what this event is all about. We'll happily watch the pros go and do it. But for you and I, we want this to really be about the achievement. For the majority of cyclists, you know, we don't do anything to encourage those records. It's really about doing this for yourself.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you to Science in Sport, who have supported the Cycling Podcast since 2016. Science in Sport's range of energy bars, gels, drinks and recovery products can really help make your fueling more efficient, whether you're going on a long ride or a short one, or whether you're going to be racing, or whether you're going to be taking it at a more sedate pace. You still need to keep hydrated and fueled so that you can, well, not hit the wall, basically. They're also launching a range of products designed for turbo training as well. And, well, the summer will give way eventually to the autumn and winter. And even if the recent turbo training boom has faded a little bit, everyone will be back on their turbo trainers over the winter, I'm sure. Now, all Cycling Podcast listeners can get 25% off Science in Sport's range of products by going to scienceinsport.com and using the code SISCP25 at the checkout. That's SISCP25.
I wasn't like devastated. I was like, oh, I'm going to have to go again. And so, like, mentally, when it's so fresh in your head still. Like, when you do something difficult, you normally, like, wait a year till you do it again. You have enough time to forget how hard it is before you do it. But that wasn't the case with this. Because I knew I had to do it again, I wanted to do it as soon as possible. To be honest, the second time around, I enjoyed it a lot more. So in a lot of ways, I'm glad I got to do it again and sort of... But yeah, I mean, I felt like I got more out of it the second time because mentally I knew what I was in for.
So tell me about Lachlan Morton then and his, well, almost back-to-back attempts. I mean, pretty mind-boggling, really, just on a physical level, let alone the mental level of finding out he'd come up short and then deciding to do it again. I mean, rules are rules, though, right?
Yeah, rules are rules. And, you know, like, it's, I think people have sort of followed the story, but Lachie set a time of 7 hours and 32. We had a look at it. It was within, you know, the same parameters that we check off all of ours, obviously with a bit of extra scrutiny. For those record attempts, we get a few people looking at it as well. Maybe a day or two after the attempt, I had an email from a publication that had done a bit of deep diving into the data and found some abnormalities and questioned us about our methodology. And we looked into it again as well and answered all their questions and sort of heard nothing for a day or two and actually thought, okay, well, that's fine. And like I said, you know, we did go through and double check our work. But then using additional software, which we didn't have access to, they've done some additional mapping on the particular segment that Lockie had done. And as it transpires, he didn't climb the height of Mount Everest. And as much as we would love to say, that's great, you know, go for it. Like we also know that we've knocked back plenty of people from being in the Everesting Hall of Fame for doing the same thing. So I had to reach out to Lockie and give him the unfortunate news, which he took okay a little bit later. He wasn't stoked, I don't think, but he was also, you know, appreciative of the fact that, you know, there were rules in place, and he pretty much said that, okay, well, he's going to have to go back and do it again now. And yeah, he went and did it. We obviously had some quite rigorous external, you know, data mapping done on the segment to make sure that there was no possibility of the same thing happening again. And, you know, we all saw he went and did a 7-hour 29 attempt, which was incredible. One of the most mortifying moments of my life, as you can imagine, having to not only put it out there as this new record and then have to pull it back again. But yeah, I was so pleased to see that he did it again. And, you know, irrespective of what happens with that record, there's a chance that it may be broken in the future. And whether it does or doesn't, I'll never remember that for the time that he set. I'll just remember him for the tenacity that he showed in just getting back on the bike and doing it again. And, you know, it's the perfect model for our crew, basically, to say, this is what you do in the face of adversity.
So there we are. Andy Van Bergen had the unenviable task of having to tell Lachlan Morton that his record attempt the first time had not been verified. We'll hear from Lachlan a little bit later on. Hannah, you spoke to him recently about his double attempt failure, then a success. Fortunately, he now holds the record as we speak, holds the record at 7 hours and 29 minutes. His ride took him a distance of 155 kilometres. But Ian, you've raced up all of the mountains of France, Italy and Spain during your pro career. But what do you make of this Everesting phenomenon, the idea of spending upwards of 7 hours riding up and down the same hill?
Yeah, it's been a bit bonkers kind of following along as, you know, more athletes and, you know, a lot of pro riders have kind of set out to break and set this record. You know, in the early days of lockdown, I was following Phil Guymon, who set the record, then another American mountain biker did it, and then Bookman from Bora did it, but he had a similar incident to Lachlan where his time was not official. And then, Lachlan not just doing it once, but, you know, essentially doing it twice over the course of a week. It's just a daunting task. And I think personally, like, just to repeat the same climb for 7 hours, there's a lot that goes into just the preparing, you know, mentally for a day like that, because up and down the same climb, you know, there's a lot to consider, both, you know, which tactic is best, a long climb or a short steep climb. And I've considered doing it. I probably won't, because the record is pretty, it's a high standard now. But you have to also think about, you know, picking a descent that's, you know, safe and easy to come down, because I'm sure at the end of 7 hours, you can, you know, be in a pretty big state of fatigue and you don't want to have a spill at all.
In terms of comparing it to a race day on the bike, I mean, roughly, do you know off the top of your head roughly what the most amount of meters gained you would have had in a stage race or a classic?
I mean, I think some of the big days of the Giro were maybe around 4,000 meters, but that's a huge day. You know, that's a day that, you know, on the team bus, you're, you know, really gearing up for and thinking that's, you know, half of an Everest challenge. And stages like that are relatively few and far between. Maybe some stages once in a while and up in Andorra have something similar in the Vuelta, but that's just, it's an immense amount of climbing. And, you know, when you hear the stats off Lachlan that, you know, it was still under 200K, but with over 8,000 feet of climbing, that's just it's a phenomenal feat to do it in the time that he did it in.
Hannah, you spoke to Lachlan, and the lowering of the record is not necessarily something that Andy Van Bergen really had in mind when he created the phenomenon of Everesting. I mean, it's a feat in itself just to complete an Everesting, really.
Yeah, and speaking to Lachlan, I mean, he's always so super chilled around life and things in general. And actually, what's quite interesting, where you said, Ian, about, you know, having to choose the descent, with what Lachlan was doing, and he explained that he, even on the descent, they had to think about what was going to be the best descent to decrease that time that it took to get to the record. So Lachlan was saying that the descent that he took was just a straight descent, and he was getting up to almost like 100 k's an hour on the descent. So there was no time to even really relax on the descent going down. It was full concentration even doing that to then start again. So, and yet to then mentally prepare yourself to go in it, to do it the 7 days later is quite incomprehensible. He still felt like his body wasn't really recovered going into it that second time. So I just can't even imagine get my head around trying to do it, really.
Well, Hannah, let's hear your chat with Lachlan Morton, a pro rider for the World Tour team, EF Pro Cycling, of course. And his two attempts were on the West Rift Canyon in Colorado in the United States of America.
It's cool that, like, during the lockdown, there are so many people getting involved in that. It's something anyone could do. So the more I thought about it, the more I was like, you know what, I might just give it a go. And then, like, I guess a week after that, I just went and did it. No, I mean, if you're trying to go fast, you need something, like, basically as steep as possible and as straight as possible, because that allows you to, like, get as many meters as you can every time you get, like, uphill. And then when you're going downhill, you're able to, like, descend really fast and get that out of the way, so you don't waste time going downhill, basically. I mean, being here in Colorado, there's not many roads like that. We're in the mountains, so most of the stuff has switchbacks and all that sort of stuff. Also, didn't want to travel anywhere. And, yeah, it was about 45 minutes down the road, and it's a climb that I'd ridden a couple of times in races, in different races before. It was pretty high. More altitude than you really want. You know, there's no perfect hill, I don't think. Well, there probably is, but not yet.
So basically, how long was the climb that you were doing it on, and how many meters did you gain each time? Because you had to do, what was it, 42 or 44 reps?
I mean, the second time, I did 47 reps. Oh, I did 48. I did an extra one. But yeah, so 47 laps, and it was like 100 or just over 190 meters. That basically broke down to like 1.6K or something at about 11.5%. So it was more or less for me, I think it was about 8 to 9 minutes going up the hill, and then like 1 minute to get down.
So basically you're only having kind of like a minute worth of recovery in between each ascent.
Yeah, and you're also doing like 110k an hour every time you're going down the hill, so you're not really fully recovering, you know. You're still pretty on it. It's one thing if you're trying to just do it, it's another if you're trying to do it fast. Like, the record's no joke. You've got to be getting after it pretty good the whole time. So yeah, there was no stopping. But you can get, like, bottles and food and that from, I had my dad there, so he was giving me the bottles and Snickers bars. No, it was almost exactly what I thought it would be, to be honest. You feel pretty good initially. You sort of start doing the laps and be like, oh, this won't be too bad. And then you start to break it down into like sections, you know, to make it more manageable in your head. And so for me, that was like halfway. I found it most difficult, like, from halfway until, like, 10 laps to go, because, like, once you get to halfway, it seems like you an impossibly long wait at the end, like, to maintain the same sort of pace and to just do that many laps. It gets, like, exponentially harder, right, because you're sort of trying to hold the same pace as your legs just get worse and worse and worse. So it, like, requires more of you mentally and physically as you go. But then once you get to, like, 10 laps to go, it it's just, I don't know, there's something about counting single digits. It seems easier again.
Did you do anything that kind of helped you? Like, were you listening to music or anything like that? Or did you say, right, okay, I'll do these 10 laps and then I'll do something that will be a bit of a treat, like on the next lap, like eating some food? Or how did you kind of break it down in that sense?
Yeah, the first time I didn't take music, and that was the big mistake. I got like genuinely a little bit bored on the first attempt, like halfway through, before it got really hard, because you're just doing the same thing. But second time around, I had a good playlist. You know, there's enough to focus on, like, especially when you're trying to go fast, there's enough to focus on, like, in the moment that you don't have a chance to think too far down the road. Like, any of those hard pieces, you always have, like, a rough patch. And there was a few, like, both times, it was maybe, like, three or four laps where I was just like, well, what am I doing out here? Like, this is stupid. I should just stop and not do this anymore. But then, you know, you come back around.
You would basically said straight after the first attempt, I'm never going to do that again. And then obviously the news came around that it wasn't verified.
Yeah.
And I guess if you leave that hanging over you, that you know you want to go out there and do it again, like it's just going to build and build that kind of the thought of like the it looming ahead of you, isn't it? Whereas if you just kind of like get out there and get back on it and do it again, was there anything you kind of learned? You kind of thought, okay, this is going to be tough, but it, and this will be the moment where potentially I'm going to find it hard, but you know you can get through it as well.
The thing is, it's like, it seems like a big deal, like, you know, online, and like everyone knows you've gone to do it, but the reality is it's just like me at home. It's just me going out to a hill, like not far from where I live, and just riding up and down it. That's why I wanted to do it sort of sooner. But yeah, I mean, like mentally, the second time around, I just sort of understood that you've only really got what you've got, you know, like you can only squeeze so much out of yourself. And a lot of the time, like, if you push like deeper than your body really can, you just kind of frustrate yourself and ultimately slow yourself down. There's something like that makes it, there's something that makes it easier about knowing that like you're able to push to your limit. You don't have to like squeeze the lemon, you know, like it's just a matter of like finding that spot and then staying there for like 7 hours.
But after the first attempt, like, how was your body feeling after that? Did it not take, were you not still feeling any fatigue in your body from the first attempt? Because you did the second attempt a week later.
I was still pretty sore. I wasn't fully recovered. A big part of it is how you are mentally and whether you're like ready to deal with that sort of effort again, and like commit to that sort of effort again. And I still had that mindset, and it was fresh. So that kind of, in my opinion, like trumps the physical aspect. It's as close to a race as I've been in a long time. So it felt a bit like a win.
Yeah,
which is cool. You know, and also like it's funny because the second you stop, you realize it was just like, you know, my mum, dad, my brother, and Rachel. And like we were just on a random hill, like in Colorado, and it's actually all very low key. I was like, all right, what are we gonna go do for lunch? You know, like that was sort of at the end of it, which is what I was sort of most not relieved. It was just like a nice thing to have done, but it's also I also knew that like I'm like I don't need to do this again. I'm sort of at peace with it.
Do you think it's one of the hardest things that you've ever done on the bike?
No, it's different. I think I'll say mentally it's hard because the format, like nothing changes. It's just you. So it's kind of like a really long time trial. So that was definitely hard. And like and that amount of focus for that amount of time was tough. But you're also like, you're fully supported, so you can get a drink bottle every 10 minutes if you need it. So in that way, it's not like, say, an ultra where you get yourself into situations where you don't have what you need, and you sort of got to keep pushing on when you're absolutely fried. I've still had, I think, more difficult moments, but I guess like as a continuous effort, it's probably one of the harder things I've done for sure.
Well, I said at the beginning that there's no real sense of exploration with an Everesting attempt because you're going up and down the same climb. I certainly mean that in a physical sense, but I guess you find out a bit, you go on a journey of exploration of a different kind. You find out a bit about what you're made of. Certainly got a lot of thinking time, and having to attempt the record twice because of just falling that little bit short the first time round, that tells you something about the mental fortitude Lachlan Morton has. But Ian, you were talking about, you know, that this whole Everesting challenge idea is fraught with a sort of technical difficulty, the worry that your bike computer or whatever it is you're recording your ride on might conk out or run out of battery or just stop recording halfway through an attempt. I mean, that's enough to discourage me, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, as Lachlan found out, you know, there's so many discrepancies just in, you know, where you get your information as far as, you know, meters gained and, you know, timing and making sure everything's charged, and then, you know, thinking about a fueling strategy. There's a lot that goes into it. And I think, you know, Lachlan's second attempt was definitely aided by probably what he learned the first time around. And, you know, because this record has become highly competitive, I would say, at the pointy end, it is taking riders and, you know, I think even with Lachlan, that their sports, the principal of EF, JV, was pretty heavily involved just to, you know, kind of crunch some numbers and see what was possible. And it's taken the whole challenge to a new level, which I think in a way is pretty fantastic for, you know, for cycling fans to see, because they can go out during this time when there isn't any racing happening and, you know, go for an Everest attempt themselves.
From your point of view, I mean, how high a bar is this that he has set? 7 hours, 29 minutes. I guess with elevation, it's almost an absolute, isn't it? Because even if you're riding on a steep climb or a shallower climb, you're still, you know, making the same amount of gain. I mean, you should be able to say, you know, how much could be trimmed off that. I mean, in terms of sort of where the bar has been set, do you think that it's something that people will look at and be slightly put off by?
I think that Lachlan's just time. I mean, I know Lachlan pretty well from racing back in the day, and he's a phenomenal, you know, he's incredibly talented. You know, he did do the effort at altitude, which maybe would suggest that, you know, it could be beaten if it was done maybe at a lower elevation. But I kind of look at it similar to the hour record or something, where it's kind of inspired a lot of, you know, high end professional athletes to, you know, consider doing this and go after that record. And I think that the bar is set high enough now that, you know, there's probably only a handful of people that can break it, and probably more so athletes that want to try to go after it, especially now that the racing has returned. But I think that it's such a cool event in the sense that, you know, amateur riders can go out and, you know, crunch the numbers, figure it out, you know, get a light bike, pick the right climb, train for it, and potentially give riders like Lachlan a run for their money.
Well, Lachlan isn't the only person who's broken the record in the past few weeks. The women's record has been broken a few times in quick succession. At the end of May, the Bowles Dolmans rider Katie Hall took 2.5 hours off the previous record. She was on a climb near Santa Cruz in the United States, and that took the record to 10 hours and 1 minute. And then Lauren DeCrescenzo, a former US pro rider, took 4 minutes off that on a climb called Hogpen Gap in Georgia. And a few days after that, it really was only a handful of days after that, Hannah Rhodes in the UK took the record on a climb that many people in the Lake District or the north of England will be familiar with, the short side of Kirkstone Pass near Penrith. And, well, she lowered the record to 9 hours and 8 minutes. And Richard Moore, our colleague from the Cycling Podcast, spoke to her.
I heard about Everesting before. We've got a friend who's done a couple of them, but I'd never really thought about doing one myself until it popped up on my Facebook feed that Katie had just broken the women's world record, and I'd kind of spent the last 2 months in the Peak District coincidentally riding up and down hills on my boyfriend's wheel, which I thought would probably be quite good training for it. It's only very recently since lockdown that people have really started doing it quickly, haven't they? riding for like 15 hours has never been something that I've found massively appealing.
So tell me about the day itself. How did you prepare for it? You mentioned the training that you'd done during lockdown, but did you do any specific training or efforts before the, you know, the day itself?
Well, the day itself actually came quite a lot sooner than the day itself was supposed to come. So in the week running up to it, I went out and did a 2-hour ride where I just rode up and down like the steepest short hill close to me to see whether I could be on the pace. And then a couple of days beforehand, I actually went out and did like a 6-hour ride with my boyfriend and another friend where I just ride up every single climb kind of hard. But then wherever the road flattened, I'd try and keep on the power. So I was only giving myself sort of those like 2-minute breaks throughout the entire 6-hour ride. The day that I went and did it was actually supposed to be a practice ride. So ideally, I would have taken like a week to taper, but I didn't end up doing that.
And what led to that? Was it, did you just feel good?
My dad said to go out and do 5 hours above the pace and to sit like, because that would give me a good indication of whether I could do it or not. But once you've done 5 hours significant and like you know that you're on to break the record, it's kind of throwing those 5 hours away to not just carry on riding.
You thought I might as well keep going.
I didn't want to have to do the 5 hours again plus another 4 hours on top of that.
Brilliant. You know, the record holder is somebody who races, you know, at the very highest level. She's one of the best climbers in the world as well. I mean, that was a serious, you know, knowing the identity of the record holder, it was a serious record to take on. I mean, how confident were you going into it or thinking about it?
I knew it would suit me and I knew that the climb that I'd picked was good. I guess what I didn't know was how I would like cope with going for the full 9 hours without taking a break. Like I know over 6 hours when I can have a coffee stop that I'm strong enough to hold a power up the climbs that would put me on pace to break the record, but I really had no idea whether I could ride for 9 hours without a break, without bonking or cracking.
Well, I was going to ask about that. I mean, if you're just going up or down, how do you fuel?
Yeah, I guess you just kind of eat constantly. I just looked for what I like a carbohydrate mix, which would allow me to take on as much carbohydrate as possible. And spent the 2 days beforehand like resting and making sure that I was eating quite a lot more than I normally would do so that my stores were like properly topped up. I knew the biggest thing that would stop me from doing it would be bonking rather than being like half a kilo to a kilo heavier. My descending is not the best at the best of times, so I ate on the uphill. I didn't want to add to the difficulty of riding downhill at 40 miles per hour, which I don't really like, by trying to eat on the descent.
What was the hardest thing about it, and what was your toughest moment?
I got really bad indigestion about hour two, so I definitely recommend like trying out your fueling beforehand, which I didn't do at all. And that carried on until about hour five, and that was really painful. Then hour 5 to 7 were quite hard just because you're tired, but also you know you've got to do a lot more. Fortunately, a friend and my dad and brother turned up at that point, which was really helpful. I guess it was all quite hard. I'm not really...
It sounds horrific. I mean, you know, how did you feel, you know, in the last hour? Did you know then that you were on course for the record, or were you sort of still trying to get as much as you could out yourself?
Like the last 4 hours, I knew that was the point where, because I've ridden up to 6 hours before and I know that I wouldn't bonk and I'd be able to keep putting the power out. For the last 4 hours, the biggest like worry in my head was just that I was going to crack completely. So I kind of knocked it off because I knew that I was on course for the record and I didn't want to lose it by cracking.
I mean, how did you feel then finishing it and realizing you had the record?
Well, I didn't know, and I'm a pretty pessimistic person, so I mainly felt worried that I wouldn't have done enough reps of the climb. There was a part of me that just wanted to keep riding up and down until I got to the time of 9 hours 57, because then there's nothing stupid that you could have done that stopped you from breaking the record.
You're a pretty pessimistic person, you said, but when you realised you'd done it, how did you feel?
Oh, I was really, really happy, yeah. maybe not quite as happy as my boyfriend, but... Yeah.
So if somebody breaks your record, would you go for it again?
depends how much they break it back. It's kind of in my head that I might go again anyway, because I'd like to do a better paced effort and an effort without having to stop to fill my water bottle up from a stream. So yeah, I think I would. If it was significantly under like 8 hours and 45 minutes, well, if it was under 8 hours and 45 minutes, I think I'd really struggle to break it.
What I really like about this Everesting idea is that it's pretty egalitarian, isn't it? You can do it on any kind of bike. There's even been wheelied attempts, people completing an Everesting on just a back wheel, which, I mean, seems unnecessary to me. That's I'm not going to do a normal Everesting, I don't think. But an Everesting on a wheelie is pushing it a bit. Hannah, you've also spoken to somebody who's kind of put their own twist on Everesting, multiple Everesting attempts on consecutive days in different countries.
Yeah, so I went and did my first face-to-face interview a week or so ago with a guy up in Girona who is, his name's Jack Thompson. He's an Australian guy who lives up there, and he basically kind of changed his life and went into doing ultra cycling. And I know that we're going to hear from him in maybe an episode or two's time a bit more about his full life story and how he kind of got into cycling and kind of how he uses it a real vehicle around mental health. But he was then talking to me about his Everesting attempt. And you kind of think, okay, setting an Everesting attempt in general is going to be pretty insane. But this guy seems to take a challenge and then raise it another bar. So he basically decided he was going to do Everesting on three different mountains in three different countries in three consecutive days, which to me feels insane, like incomprehensible. I can't really get my head around that. How you even try and have the energy to be able to do that with very little sleep. So it was interesting to chat to him about it.
So I'd had a plan for a year that I wanted to chase down the Tour de France. So the plan was that I was going to give the Tour Peloton a 10-day head start. They'd leave the start of wherever they were leaving from, ride for 10 days, and then I was going to start and try and chase them to the finish. And for whatever reason, last year, the funding for the film on that project fell through. And so I had this opening to come up with an idea. And I remember I was actually running a tour in Bhutan, some gravel tours, and one of the guys on the trip said to me, you know, he's a mate of mine from Australia, was saying, you know, what are you going to do? And we started trying to plan something that had the theme of a grand tour, but wasn't a grand tour. And we came up with this concept, the Grand Tours Everesting Project, where you've got the three grand tours in Italy, France, and Spain. And what I wanted to do was Everest the highest peaks in Italy, France, and Spain in 3 days, basically non-stop. So the highest peak in Italy was the Stelvio. In France, it was Col de Libanais. And in France, it was actually Pico Valletta down in Granada. But due to logistical issues, it wasn't going to work out. So we chose Porta Envalira in Andorra. Basically flew into Italy, drove to Stelvio, basically Everested Stelvio.
How many times do you have to do Stelvio to Everest?
I think it was 6 times. So it was like 500 switchbacks or something, up and down. So we Everested Stelvio and then immediately got in the van and drove to France and Everested Col de Libanais, which was again 7 ascents. And then immediately got in the van and drove to Andorra and did Porta Envalira. So I managed to do the three Everestings, which was 26,768 metres of climbing in 3 days across three countries.
Whoa. And probably that is the kind of ascent that they would do in total across maybe, I know maybe they would do a bit more in the tour, but yeah, around that, about that kind of level.
Yeah, that challenge pushed me, especially the final climb, because it was 40 odd degrees in Andorra, obviously at a little bit of altitude, and after 3 days of living in a van, my nutrition was out the window. I was eating Burger King and I just couldn't get enough calories in. And yeah, so that's the first time I've really struggled in a challenge, but yeah, we managed to get through it and we had an hour to spare at the end, so yeah.
I remember listening to you say in one of the videos that whenever you're going through that a really hard period or a hard moment in a challenge, you think it, you break it down to actually the percentage of your life that you'll spend in that moment of real kind of suffering.
Yeah.
And in comparison to the rest of your life, that it's nothing.
Yeah.
But how did you start to think of that kind of, or like try and break it down in that kind of way?
One of the things I do when I'm writing is, like, to pass the time, I'll do my times tables. So I'll pick any number, so 37, for example, and I'll just work through 37, 74, da-da-da-da-da, all the way up. And so I'm always working with numbers in my mind. And I remember that then translate to, for example, okay, I've got 26,000 metres of climbing to do. That's going to take 3 days. 3 days, it's half a week. You know, that's, you know, 1/8 of a month, whatever, you know. Like, I just start breaking things down into these micro segments again. And then I've started working in percentages. So it was, you know, this is 1 day of a year. So it's, you know, 1/365. And then I apply a percentage, and it just, it's a nice way to actually break down how small an amount of time you're actually suffering for. And so while at the time it feels like, oh my God, I've got another 6 hours of this. Like, 6 hours is only a quarter of a day. Like, it's tiny. And it, for me, that helps.
Well, at the start of the podcast, I talked about what may be the first known Everesting effort on a bike. I really love the sort of symmetry of George Mallory, the grandson of the mountaineer George Mallory, who, of course, died during a mountaineering trip to Everest in the 1920s. And George Mallory, his grandson, did the first Everesting on a bike, we thought, in 1994 in Australia, as Andy explained. But with the phenomenon having kind of taken off in recent months, Andy received an email from a Frenchman called François Sion. He sent Andy an email to explain that on July the 1st, 1984, he rode repetitive climbs of the Col de la Force in the Jura Mountains until he had scaled Everest on a bike, and he did it in 13 hours and 30 minutes. And, well, he's 78 now and still riding very regularly. And I caught up with François on the phone to ask him how the idea came about.
They were really presenting mountaineering as a really hard sport physically. But to me, you know, having done a little bit of climbing in Bolivia, you know, and found it so easy, you know. I mean, I don't know. Maybe I want to show that Everest, after all, was not such a big deal. Of course, the difficulty of mountaineering is not physical. It's just knowing, well, when you get above 8,000, obviously your ability to cope with altitude and knowing the mountain and knowing the techniques and the survival and all that, not the physical aspects, you know. So anyway, you know, I thought it was a nice challenge to do the height of the Everest, even though in terms of physical exertion, it's only maybe half of the effort it would take from sea level to the height of the Everest if there was a route leading up there, you know. So going up the Everest and dealing with your reduced efficiency of your engine, if you want, it's really close to double the effort, you know. It's closer to 15,000 meters at sea level in terms of physical.
In summer 1984, I mean, 36 years ago last week.
And
in fact, July the 1st, 1984 was my 9th birthday. So I remember that day, actually. So I remember what I was doing on the day that you were riding. So you chose a climb, and tell me why you chose this particular climb.
I lived less than 10 kilometers away from the bottom of the climb. Of course, it's not the optimal in terms of minimizing time, you know, because to minimize the time, you have to have a steep incline. But I've always preferred to climb 6-7% than 10% or more, you know. So first half is just under 6% for the average of first 6 kilometers. Then it's slightly over 7% for the last 5 kilometers. So it falls in a range of percentages that just suited me. And the downhill is fairly fast. I mean, it's not the fastest, but you don't have to brake all that much, you know. So you can do, without taking chances, you can go down in 12 minutes or some or a bit more, you know. So it's, you know, you don't lose too much time going downhill. So I thought it was okay on that for that. And then, of course, I could have local support because there was at that time I had the bike club from which was local. You know, I got in contact with the owner of the Peugeot. You know, as told in this in the story in Everesting.cc. You know, I got the owner of the shop to lend me his Peugeot carbon bike. It was a little bit lighter than mine. You know, it was 8.2 kilos instead of maybe 9 something for mine, you know, so it was a slight advantage. And then especially, and then he got two of his employees to relay behind me on the motor scooter. So the people of the area knew about it and, you know, came to cheer. And it was a better choice than going far away from my bases, you know.
The climb was the Col de la Fossile, which the
Tour de... Col de la Fossile, yeah.
Which the Tour de France had used in the past.
Yeah.
And you also, you had a Peugeot jersey, the famous jersey.
Yeah. I still have it, actually. Yeah, so, you know, so that was given to me by the owner of the bike shop, yeah.
And how long did the ride take you?
I remember I started at 12 past 6, and I finished the 13th climb at 19:42, so it took me 13 hours and 30 minutes, basically, to do the 13 climbs. But, you know, my hope was that somebody would try to do better, you know. And since I still had a margin, you know, I could shave on lost time because I took my time to eat at one point. So I was hoping that somebody would do better. But not by 2 hours, of course. And also, I could try to be the new best time, you know. But it didn't happen, you know. Nobody picked up the idea.
Well, you got a lot of media coverage. I've seen in the article, you know, the Dauphiné Libéré covered it, and you also got the record into the Guinness Book of Records.
Yeah, but that still didn't attract the people, you know. I don't know. So I was a bit disappointed, yeah, that nobody followed suit, you know.
I mean, how much did you calculate that you would definitely be making the right elevation gain to say I've climbed the height of Everest? Because there was no GPS mapping. You had to go from, I guess, paper maps and local knowledge.
Actually, beforehand, I had a mistake on the altitude at the bottom. And then the day after, I called the mairie, you know, a city hall, to ask the altitude. And I also have a cycling colleague who is a surveyor for CERN. And so they have all the maps. I ask him to get the exact altitude for me. You see, in France, you see two sets of altitude. You see Michelin altitude. And you see Institut Géographique National, the National Geographic Institute, and there is quite often 2 meters difference. So the bottom of the climb, if you go by one set, is 609 meters, and if you go by another, it's 612 or whatever. And the top can be either 1321 or 1323, but the difference is definitely 711 meters.
But I suppose that would make it more difficult for people to have a go, whereas now with Strava and GPS data, it is easier to calculate and work out how many climbs you would need to do. There's a lot more information available. So maybe you were just 25, nearly 30 years ahead of your time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so, thinking about the recent developments, the act of climbing the height of Everest on a single bike ride has become very popular. People are doing it all around the world now. And
yeah.
So, how did you kind of hear of Andy's attempt to basically make an official Well, he's basically made an official apparatus for people to submit their rides, and then he and his group will verify that the ride meets the criteria.
Yeah, well, you know, with this confinement, of course, you know, I had time to devote to things I would not do otherwise, you know. So I said, you know, I had heard about this Everest thing with Jens Voigt and other people like that, and I figured I would look, but who is behind all this? So I found on the internet about Health 500, and so I sent an email to Andy, you know, so that's how it started, and he was thrilled to hear about me.
He had assumed that the first Everesting on a bike had been George Mallory in 1994, but you had done it 10 years earlier.
Yeah, and so maybe somebody else did it even earlier, you know. So it's funny, yeah.
And what do you think of the record now, Lachlan Morton and...
Now it's becoming really serious business, you know. So to me, you know, I would prefer people choosing longer climb, you know, that because I think it's different doing... first of all, if you make short climbs with little altitude difference, you have so many repeats that you need more and more accuracy on the altitude difference. So I would have liked if they had a minimum, like maybe 500 meters or something like that. But of course, that would exclude all types of people who would have to travel to do it. So it's not such a good idea. But I know from my own climbing in stairs that the fact that I... You know, that when I did 10,000 meters in stairs, the fact that I could, that had a little over 1 minute rest every 5 minutes or less than 5 minutes suited me better than having a long climb with a 45 minutes effort, you know, followed by a 13 minutes rest, if you want. So, but, you know, I mean, basically, like some people, they have a 30, a guy who did 30 meter altitude difference had to do it 300 times or something like that. You know, that's has its own difficulty in it. You know, doing 300 times the same climb. You know, I prefer it so much to do the fossé 13 times because over the course of a day, you know, that everything changes. The view changes. The sun moves around, so the you see the Alps in the distance, you know, and the lake, and you have things to look at, and so I think it's in that respect, you know, La Fossée is really a great place to do it.
Well, it was fascinating to talk to Francois about his Everesting attempt in 1984, successful attempt, of course. One thing that we didn't talk about was the gearing that he used, and the lowest gear he had was 42.23, which by today's standards is a pretty massive gear, right, Ian?
Yeah, I mean, I've been running a lot of one by gear systems on my gravel bikes, and yeah, I think I have a 42 up front and a 50 in the rear, so I have a bit more gear to spin for climbing. It's one thing that, you know, when I was racing that directors always commented on is that we're not as tough anymore because we have too small of gears.
Well, I mean, Francois is obviously fascinated by the mountains, and with his scientific background, working for the European Organization for Nuclear Research, CERN, as the acronym is in French. So, you know, one of the things that we kind of talked about there was the difficulty of calculating the exact altitude gain, which of course now is much easier with Strava. We can all kind of work out, we take our local hill, see how many meters of elevation one ascent will give, and go from there. It's a lot easier than trying to do it by, well, as Francois was saying, just double checking the elevation stats with the local mayor's office. I mean, you know, that's one barrier that has definitely been removed for people now, and probably explains why the Everesting idea has gained in popularity in recent years. Just another note on Francois. When he was working at the CERN HQ in Switzerland, he wanted to see whether he could reach 10,000 meters
quicker on foot or by bike, and he did 100 ascents of a 100 meter deep stairwell in the Large Electron Positron Collider, which took him over 11 hours, but it did prove to be quicker than gaining 10,000 meters on a bike, which is interesting.
Interesting or slightly crazy. I can't believe that. I'm sure there must be some kind of positive charge around that building or something to keep you going, to allow you to be able to do that kind of thing. I mean, unbelievable.
Quite a character, yeah. But this this whole phenomenon, I mean, I'd mentioned the idea of doing an Everesting just as a wheelie, but there's been a brakeless track bike attempts. There've been multiple attempts in one ride. I mean, that seems to be taking things to extreme. And Andy van Bergen himself has attempted to Everest on Everest. There's a paved road from Lhasa to the base camp on the Tibetan side of Mount Everest. The altitude is really considerable. I mean, I think it starts at 5,200 meters. And Andy said during his attempt, he got a couple of thousand meters of gain in. He'd been riding for 8 hours and then he got pretty bad altitude sickness and was having proper hallucinations and crashed and nearly went over a guardrail and abandoned his attempt to Everest at Everest. The closest Everesting to Everest is by a Chinese rider called JJ Zhao. And that's the way to Everest by going on the paved road from Lhasa to the base camp. There's also a Canadian mountain biker, Ian, you may know the name, Corey Wallace, who has Everested on the Nepalese side. Everesting at Everest, that seems to be taking the idea to an even greater extreme.
Wow. Yeah, well, I guess I've been reading some articles where Victor Campenarch has been sleeping in his altitude tent at 10,000 meters. So who knows? He's one for trying to break a record. Maybe he's going to fly over to Nepal and go for the record on Everest.
That seems to be taking it to extremes. What can the possible gain be? Is that not just law of diminishing returns once you get over that height?
Yes, I think most people would probably agree that it's just too much. It's just too stressful on your body. But I guess he's experimenting, and you know, now's a time when before racing returns that I guess you can put your body through some tests and see if there is any benefit. But I think that conventional science would say that sleeping or spending any time at 10,000 meters is probably too high.
Last question for you on Everesting, Ian. If of all the climbs you've ridden across Europe and North America and the rest of the world, is there one that you could stand to make an Everesting attempt on, something that you're going to be seeing for 7.5 hours? Well, let's be ambitious. 7 hours, 25 minutes.
Ooh, I'm not the best descender, but if I had to pick a climb that was entertaining enough to repeat, I would probably do Col de Lombard from Nice up to Isola 2000. We did it in the 2016 Giro, and a lot of riders recently have been spending time up there, but it's a beautiful climb. It's steep enough to probably, you know, actually be a record attempt. And you're in the mountains, so it's a bit cooler up there and some gorgeous views and no traffic.
Hannah? Put you on the spot there.
I have to think
you're,
about a
you're
climb.
Not committing to a record attempt here. I just want to make that clear.
I don't know actually. None around here because it's too hot, especially right now at the moment. It's way too warm. I'll have a think about that, Lionel, and come back to you, because I feel like if I do say it, then I might commit myself to it mentally that I have to go and do it. So I'm not going to say.
Well, Andy van Bergen said that whenever he's contemplating an Everesting attempt, what he does is he commits it to the public record. He basically says on social media, I guess, that that's what he's doing. And then once you've committed publicly, you can't back out.
Exactly, which is why I'm not going to say it on a podcast.
Absolutely. the last word to François Siouan then, because I asked him at the end what his best tip would be for somebody who's thinking of making an Everesting attempt, but perhaps is at the very beginning of their climb. And he suggested pick a climb you like and start off by doing 4 reps and then maybe 7 and then 10 and see how you're going. And I think that feels like quite a modest and manageable way to attempt it. And Andy van Bergen suggested that if I can't tackle the full Everesting challenge, what about a half Everesting? I wonder if I could do a half Everesting in the time it took Lachlan Morton to do a full Everesting. I still think that would be a push.
I think you can do it. There you go. I think you've now committed to yourself now, Lionel. Yeah. That's it. By next episode, yeah, we want a date.
You put it out there.
A date and a time when this is going to start.
I'm trying to work out here whether I've stitched myself up or whether you two have stitched me up. But, well, I'll think about that. I'll think about that. I'll see how the Tour de Home, you know, if I come out of the Tour de Home with, you know, real form, then maybe I'll give it a go. But I've got a couple of climbs near me in mind that I might go and just try and do half a dozen reps of and see what the experience is like. Well, that's our episode on Everesting. I think we'll branch out a little bit more in next month's episode. Hopefully, we're getting to the point where we can start bringing some stories of adventures to far and wide. Ian, you're off on your bikepacking trip, so hopefully you'll be sending in a fascinating audio diary from your ride. We're looking forward to hearing that. In the meantime, listen out to all the rest of the episodes that we've got to offer on the Cycling Podcast. We're looking forward to racing resuming at the start of August, and we'll be covering that before hopefully heading off to the Tour de France at the end of August. Thank you very much to everyone who has helped us with this episode, but especially to Andy Van Bergen. And if you want to check out the rules for an Everesting attempt of your own or look at the Hall of Fame, you can do so by going to the website everesting.cc. This has been an episode of Explore for the Cycling Podcast. The producer was Will Jones. Thank you very much from me, and thank you, Ian.
Thank you, Lionel.
And thank you, Hannah.
Thank you, Lionel.